Hello, and welcome to another episode of This is the Greatest Song I've Ever Heard in My Entire Life, a podcast about the music we love and why we love it. I am Scott Interante, and joining me, as always, Catherine Moore. Catherine, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's Oscar Monday. It's a big weekend. Yeah, how are you doing?
We're done.
Award season is over.
The end of the award season, yeah. And look, I know we are not a movie podcast, although we keep talking about
movies,
and this episode we will talk about a piece of film score as the song pick. So you know, we just got to embrace it. But yeah, I mean, Oscars last night. I think we'll keep our conversation about the music just to be a little brief about it. But let's start maybe at the performances. Yeah. Were there things that really stood out that, you know, good, bad, whatever?
We can talk about the I'm Just Ken, which we will. I think that was definitely the highlight of the night.
Yeah.
But I kind of liked the Becky G performance. It was just like fun. I don't know.
Yeah.
I was like kind of into it. I thought the performance of the song from Colors of the Flower Moon was very good. But just like having that be one of the performances was just really cool. It was just like something that I hadn't seen before on a, such a big stage. So that was cool.
Totally agree. You know, unfortunately, that film didn't end up with any awards. So it was nice that that song got to be there as like, hey, this is like a good summary of, you know, what the film is and that kind of thing. But I do think that we need to talk about
I'm just Ken. It was great.
It was a great performance. It was really well choreographed, you know, him starting in the audience, him coming up. They had a couple of the movie Kens. I know, you know,
Simu Liu,
Shruti Gatwa, and I think the Evans brother, right? The Scott Evans?
Scott, yeah. I was like, the gay Evans, yes, is there.
Yeah, and Kingsley Benadir. Yeah. And, you know, they had, like, the homage to Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, the Diamonds Are Girls' Best Friend. He was great.
Yeah, he was wonderful.
And so charming and looked really, like, comfortable.
Yes.
Like, I think the attitude from him this season has kind of been like, don't make me do it. Like, we don't have to do this. But then when he did it, he was like, you know, he owned it.
He's an amazing performer.
Nice. Totally.
Yeah, I thought that was awesome.
Yeah. And then to talk about the performance and the win for Billie Eilish, What Was I Made For? It was, you know, we knew it was going to happen.
Yep.
She's performed it a couple times now. You know, we saw it at the Grammys. I thought this was nice with the addition of the orchestra.
The orchestra was beautiful.
Yeah, it's nice that, you know, her and Phineas got their second Oscar. And honestly, I'm sure they'll have more. Like, once you sort of become known as reliable songwriters for movies, like, they're just going to keep getting asked. So as long as they're game to do it, I'm sure we'll see them here again.
I love the way that they talk about their process. I will also say this is now the first Glee alum to have won 2 Academy Awards, because Phineas O'Connell was on Glee.
Wow, yeah.
So that is something special. Anyway.
Leah Michelle, come on, get your act together.
Okay, the score win, should we talk about that?
Yeah, Oppenheimer.
Yes.
Ludwig Göransson.
Yeah, that was cool. What did you think about that win?
Yeah, again, I think it was like totally expected, but deserved. You know, I think he did an incredible job with the score. It plays a massive role in the movie itself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he seems like a really nice guy. It's so funny, he was kind of started out like doing the music for Community and producing like pop stuff. He was Ryan Coogler's roommate in college, and like that's kind of how he got into like doing stuff. It's like crazy. But he's super talented. Like, it's totally deserved. So that's the Oscars. You know, let us know if you have any thoughts of those wins or anything else. You know, we always love talking about the Oscars, and now we can get ready for next year. You know, Moana 2, Wicked will probably have some new songs.
Wicked.
You know, who knows what else will come up.
We'll see.
But Catherine, I know we always like to highlight some of the songs our audience has been listening to. What do we got lately?
Jerome said last week, Where My Heart Will Take Me by Russell Watson, which is the theme for Star Trek Enterprise, written by Diane Warren.
There she is.
That's fun.
She's everywhere.
She's clapping in the audience. It's a flaming hot theme suit. It was very cool.
You know what? Honestly, her suit was amazing.
I'm not joking.
And I just want to say, like, for the sort of meme of what Diane Warren has kind of become with these Oscar songs for movies that no one's seen. Diane Warren has an incredible career of truly amazing songs.
Yes.
This being one of them.
Yes.
And, you know, I think we always need to like take a step back and be like, no, she is the way she is because she is actually a legend.
Yes. Yes. I love that. Angela said Miss Me Too by Griff, and just a banger of
a bop
song by Griff coming out. And my cousin Annabelle put in the Bohemian Rhapsody rock version, which I could not find. It was quote-unquote hard rock version. I searched that in Spotify because I was like, maybe that's the title of like the cover, but I only found the disco version. But apparently she meant the one by Chugga-Boom, which is way more hard rock. So, you know, I do love a cover, I gotta say. I love the variety of songs that we get suggested by our audience. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Scott, do you want to talk about your show that you went to recently?
Oh, yeah. I saw The Beaches this past weekend.
Yeah.
Of course, we had Jordan Miller, the lead singer and bass player of The Beaches, on the show.
Yes. So cool.
It was really fun. They were great. And yeah, I mean, go back and listen to our episode with Jordan because it was a ton of fun.
So there's a little album that dropped on Friday. You might have heard of it. It's by Ariana Grande called Eternal Sunshine. And I have to tell you, it's a bop all around. It is front to back bangers. You have to listen to We Can't Be Friends, parentheses, Waiting for Your Love. It is Max Martin produced, so like a lot of the album is. It's like straight off of early 2000s Robin. It is so good. Of course, Max Martin would be producing both, so it makes sense why it has a similar like feeling.
Right.
It's a little early, but I think it might be Song of the Summer. So you'll have to listen to it and see if you agree.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's, I did listen to the album once, but I did not know that little tidbit about its backstory.
Yeah. So well, Max Martin really did a lot of the songs on this album, and you can really tell like the production is really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a bop of an album. I really highly recommend it. So
cool.
We should get into our episode maybe.
Yeah. So today we have Chris P. Thompson. He is a composer and percussionist, a member of the contemporary music ensemble Alarm Will Sound. He also has a new album of music that he produced and composed and recorded called Stay the Same, which is coming out pretty soon on April 4th. And he was just a ton of fun to talk to. We got to speak about not necessarily a song, but a piece of score from a film, which is like a fun change of pace. So it was great.
Yeah.
Let's get right into
it. Sounds good.
All right. Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to talk to you because we don't have a lot of opportunities to talk to people who are sort of outside of the, like, you know, traditional commercial popular music world. We talk usually to artists, indie artists, or journalists, or people who are sort of in that sphere. And so I love to get to talk to people who exist outside of that. And you are someone who is a composer and performer in contemporary classical music. How did you get to be in a spot like that? And like, what was the path like of making this your career?
I was in school as a percussionist. Mm-hmm. And I was doing that. And what I found over the course of my time in school was I met a lot of composers and other performers, and it just sort of turned into playing in small ensembles and playing chamber music. And those people I started working with when I got out of school. And next thing I know, I was playing a lot of contemporary music and I really liked it. And so I stuck with it and I ended up with a group called Alarm Will Sound. That's sort of my main gig as a percussionist. Yeah. And it's been a really varied career, I'd say.
Yeah. You know, I know, like, because, you know, I went through some of the conservatory stuff too. And a lot of performers have a sort of indifference at best and antagonism at worst to a lot of contemporary concert music. Were you always into it? Were you open to it? Were you like excited to sort of do stuff that's outside of the traditional classical concert canon?
Yeah, I was excited because it's really hard.
Yeah.
And all everything you can do in classical music is hard, and contemporary music is hard in like a really specific way, which is the same kind of hard as what I did when I was in high school, which is drum and bugle corps.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's a sort of cult-like activity that's like, so the demands as a musician in those settings was something that sort of translated to contemporary music, I guess, as far as I see it. It seemed like familiar challenges to me to play contemporary music.
I'm curious too, because, and this is going to be very reductive because we don't have the time to get into more of the nuance here, but Alarm Will Sound is often together with groups like Bang on a Can and other sort of like what you might call like the post-minimalist school of contemporary classical concert music. And a lot of that cadre of composers and musicians pull a lot from performing and recording techniques of popular music of the last century as well, and a lot of those elements of more rock music and electronic music. Is that something specifically, like, when you were growing up, I assume you were listening to a lot of popular music. Like, is that something that has drawn you to that sort of specific side of contemporary music?
Growing up, I was sort of listening to the same stuff anyone my age would have been listening to, MTV and all the pop stuff that was out, and nothing really remarkable, except in hindsight, I've noticed that I was sort of indoctrinated at a young age subliminally to like electronic music, in that certain things really stuck out to me when I was a little kid. The one that always comes to mind is like, there was like a PBS station announcement that used the Wendy Carlos Brandenburg Concerto from Switched on Bach, which was just like the most wonderfully strange thing I'd ever heard.
Yeah, absolutely. So the mainstream music or commercial music you were being exposed to was not really catching your attention, I guess.
Yeah, no, I always had this sense of like, I was just watching MTV and sort of like waiting for the thing that I was it's like there was something I knew must exist that I just wasn't seeing. Right. And I got a little taste of it with sort of Beck and the sampling that kind of stuff. And then it wasn't until I stumbled across Aphex Twin when I was, I think it was in my first year of college, when I was like, that's it. That's the thing. That's the thing I've been looking for.
That's cool.
And that sort of sent me down the late 90s electronic music rabbit hole.
Well, I'm curious about your composing. You have a new album coming out called Stay the Same, which I got the chance to listen to early, and it's pretty incredible stuff. And I'd love to hear more about the writing of that and how it came together. But just more generally, when did you decide you wanted to also be composing music in addition to performing?
Composing and performing were in parallel when I was in high school and when I was learning music just in general. And then when I went to music school, I sort of had to choose one path or another, and I leaned toward performing. And, you know, for the first 15 years out of school, that's what I was doing. I was, you know, playing percussion for a living and trying to find time to compose. And I would say it was around like 2014, 15, where I sort of realized that writing music was what I had always done and always really wanted to do, sort of first priority, but that it was a harder path for me for whatever reason, and that I really needed to commit to it if I was going to find my way onto that path. And so I sort of forced myself to make it my first priority starting at that point.
And that has manifested itself. I mean, you've been releasing albums that are not necessarily what I would think of as like a composer's album. It's not something that you're writing that an ensemble is performing. You're sort of doing everything. It's a lot of electronics and sequencing and this cool text-to-speech stuff and piano. Was that a sort of conscious decision of saying, I want to do something that's a little outside of like the concert music rep? Or is it more of like a logistic thing of like, well, if I'm doing everything, I can do it easier and cheaper?
It's definitely both. I really, really like to like create a thing, like paint a picture and hang it on the wall.
Sure. Yeah.
I've never been completely comfortable with the idea of creating a work and having it still be alive after it leaves my hands. And that's what it means to be a contemporary music composer, is like you're creating a work and then you hand it to other musicians who are then going to realize it. And that's beautiful. I've done that my whole career on the other side of things. Playing other composers' music. But what I always really wanted to do was lock myself in a room and make something that when I walk out of that room is done. And that's what the albums that I've released up to this point, that's what all of those albums are.
Cool. Now that you're established in this world as both a performer and a composer, what is your listening habits like now and what really draws you to something?
So I will listen to Aphex Twin and Boards of Canada like until the day I die. To me, that is the music that I've just been drawn to forever. And when I discovered it, I was like, that's it, you know?
Yeah.
During 2020 and 2021, I rediscovered a lot of dance music. Mm-hmm. I was throwing these Zoom dance parties, which is, most people who know me would be like pretty shocked, but I guess we all did things during that
time. We did a lot of weird things.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did whatever we needed to survive. It's okay.
And so I was really mining like Bandcamp and stuff to find really, really interesting, like fun, joyous dance music. And I found so much interesting stuff that was completely new to me and that I'm still kind of listening to fairly regularly.
Cool.
What's the thing that makes you say like, oh, this is something I want to bring to a dance party or this is something I really like? What makes it listenable for you?
It's hard. It's kind of intangible. I mean, it's weird. It's like being a drummer. I'm sort of thinking deeply about the rhythm of these tracks and I'm more likely to be drawn to something that's like slightly more unconventional.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the, you know, age-old DJ thing of, like, I'm going to expose you to this cool thing that you didn't know existed, you know?
Yes.
Which is, like, Bandcamp's, Bandcamp's a wonderful place to find stuff to do that. But, yeah, and I was never a person who danced ever. So,
yeah.
if it made me move, I felt like it was going to make anyone move.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have this pet theory that I talked about on the show before that's if you were a musician growing up, mostly sang in choirs or did theater stuff, that you grew up to be like more of a lyrics person. But if you play the instrument, like violin in my case, or percussion in your case, that you grew up to be more of a music person versus lyrics person. Does that pet theory make sense to you?
The pet theory absolutely makes sense. I have thought about that many times myself about people. I have a similar pet theory about like, are you a rhythm person or a harmony person? Or like you could say a melody or harmony person.
Ooh, I like that.
I would say that until I was about 20, in my early 20s, there could be words to a song, but I would have had zero idea what they were. I mean, it was just going straight in one ear and out the other. I was hearing everything about the vocal except what words were being said.
The tone of the timbre, everything. And it's like they could be saying gibberish for all I know.
Totally. And it changed. It definitely changed for me. I don't know how like cliche this is or like this is like dad stuff or whatever, but it was really Steely Dan where I started listening to the lyrics. And there was something so incredibly like coded and vague about it in a way where it's like you can listen to those songs and they're unspecific enough that you can make the whole story up in your own head about what the song's about. And I really liked that. And I really sort of felt like if I ever were to write words, like that is the way that I would approach it, you know?
All right. Well, it's time. Chris Thompson, what is the song that makes you scream? This is the greatest song I've ever heard in my entire life.
I chose The Grid by Philip Glass.
We're stretching the definition of what it means to be a song.
Not really a song, actually.
It's not really, but it's a piece of music, and that counts as well. So this is from, I like that you didn't say it, so you're going to make me say it. This is from the score to the film Koyaanisqatsi. I apologize to everyone in India
for my
pronunciation, but I feel like it was kind of close. But this is an incredible film that I just watched for the first time last week when I knew that we were going to do this episode. I kind of always been putting it off because I was like, okay, you know, it's cool footage and Philip Glass music, and I can kind of imagine what that's like. And I was so wrong. it is a really powerful and moving piece of filmmaking in a way that, like, you can't just describe what it is. Like, they wouldn't get it. Just go watch it. It's on Tubi and other places, so everyone should check it out. But when did this first come into your life?
This would fall under the category of, like, dorm room cult classics originally. So
yeah.
I'm sure that the first time I saw it was, like, in my undergrad, and it was like, hey, let's watch this really weird thing. At that point, I would have had no idea who Philip Glass was. I would not have understood the context for that music at all. It was like nothing I'd ever seen, for sure.
Yeah.
Every time I came back to it, it somehow had more power than the time before. To the point where now, I mean, I just think it's one of the most, to me, one of the most powerful works of art ever made, like, unquestionably.
Yeah. And so for people who haven't seen it, just to give a little context, this is a film from 1982, Godfrey Reggio. It is a wordless documentary. It starts out with just like this incredible footage of nature and this, like, you know, contemplating the beauty and power of our world. And then it starts to transition into humans living in that world and the destructive power that we can have. So it becomes footage of cities and workers and people moving around. And the section that you're talking about here, The Grid, which I agree, I think is the best music and filmmaking of the whole thing, is a lot of this sped up, time-lapsed footage of people in cities walking around, going to work, shopping, moving around streets. It's so hypnotic and powerful. And I was just listening to it again on my way home from work, walking, you know, through Midtown Manhattan,
yeah,
listening to this music. It gives it a whole different vibe.
That's a good way to do it. This piece is so shocking to me. The pacing of it from start to finish, the way that it gradually builds and builds and builds. A lot of, again, I say quote unquote minimalist because the composers don't really like that. I don't think Philip Glass likes that name, but this is common in that musical style of using repetition and making subtle, small changes that gives something a very, very large, broad arc. If you were to drop the needle at any particular place in this piece, you would get one impression that's not exactly the same as if you start it from the beginning and go to the end. The one that I always think about is just every time the vocals come in, it's just so, it's violent. It's like horrifying.
Yeah.
And what's so funny about the fact that it's horrifying is that if you were to just listen right from there, it's so joyful sounding. I mean, it's all these major chords and major and dominant chords. It's it's a very joyful, celebratory sound. And then at the same time, you realize that it's like suffocating you with that joy.
Yeah.
And I really started to feel like this piece, I mean, it was prophetic for sure in 1982, but if you want to talk about like where we're at now with regard to like choking on dopamine and just intoxication of overstimulation and the way it feels, it's like it's just more powerful now than it has ever been.
Yeah.
I found it so shocking, and I still find it shocking, like after listening to it like 100 times.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the vocals because I think that's my favorite aspect of this score. Like you're saying, it's this really aggressive tone of the vocals, whereas like thinking of other, you know, the sort of totemic minimalist pieces like A Music for 18 Musicians by Steve Reich, which uses vocals in an extremely different, calming, like sort of, it's a way of like bringing the human voice into the music in like a positive, hey, remember we're all humans way. And this is like bringing the human voice into a, hey, remember we are all humans here in like a bad way. And I think that's really interesting.
There's a horrific violence to it. That maybe sounds like a little over the top, but I just, every time those vocals come in, it's just like my whole body tenses up, and it so perfectly suits the images that you're seeing. It's just the way that we are living inside of technology and we aren't able to really get the big picture to see what's happening to us. And it's getting faster and faster and more intense. And it's like a ride we can't get off anymore.
Yeah, what a bummer.
I know. Yeah, it's happy stuff. There's a point in this track where I'm always like, wait a second. No, I want off. Get me off this thing.
Yeah,
no,
yeah,
this isn't fun anymore. Like, I want off, you know? And that's the way the film is too. It's like, before you know it, you're terrified, you know?
Yeah.
It really goes to show how much those two, like, visual and audio interact in film too. And this is like a brilliant example of it, is like, you can apply this sort of dance to a lot of different films, and some obviously do it better than others in terms of like needle drops and soundtracks and scoring. But knowing that just watching the visuals without the score and vice versa, you would still get probably a lot of the experience of, you know, tense and nature and anxiety they clearly want you to feel in some respects, but you wouldn't get the full, like, oh my God, I have to turn this off. Like, I can't watch this anymore feeling without both of those. And I just think that's a really interesting dance that clearly, you know, Philip Glass had with the filmmaker as well.
It's an ideal case study of collaboration in making a work, you know, in this case a film, where the music and the film were conceived sort of together. And as a person who wants to do scoring for film, that is like the dream situation, you know, where they stand on equal footing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us and talking to us about your own music and this incredible Philip Glass score for this incredible film. If people want to find out more about you, what you're doing, where should they go?
ChrisPThompson.com.
Nice.
I would love it if you listened to my music on Bandcamp.
Yeah.
Or any of the other streaming services.
And I know that pretty soon, later this month, you are doing a performance with Alarm Roll Sound at Carnegie Hall as well, right?
Yes. Alarm will be playing Zankel Auditorium at Carnegie Hall Tuesday, March 26th. And we're doing a new work. Well, it's the New York premiere of a work by me.
Nice.
Arranged by me and our bass player. It's an arrangement of a remix. So
cool.
It's a track from an early album that I remixed at a later album that we then rearranged for this live ensemble that we'll be doing at Carnegie Hall.
Very cool. All right. Well, everyone should check that out. And thanks so much. And hopefully we'll talk more soon.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Catherine, what did you think? Philip Glass, Koyaan and Tsukasi.
Yeah, I thought this was such a cool piece to talk about. I'm so glad that we get in just awesome musicians and folks to talk about music that I've not really been exposed to. I've listened to Philip Glass before. I actually got to see him play one time. He came to my little college in little small town Iowa in 2014 and played piano. So I got to see him, which was really cool. But
that's
I've
awesome.
Never heard of this film before now and listened to The Grid or anything else. So it was like, it just introduced me to this expansive film and score that I had no idea about. And it was really cool to get to experience. So yeah, what's your background with this?
Yeah, I've always been more of a Steve Reich guy than a Philip Glass guy. Not that you
is it
like,
a binary?
Need to pick. It's yeah, it's, you know, it's like a Beatles versus the Stones kind of thing.
Okay.
I don't know. But yeah, like I said in the episode, I just think the film and the score to go along with it is so powerful. I hope, like, it seems like one that might get played in some rep movie theaters or like, you know, the there's some museums here like the MoMA that do film screenings. Like, I feel like I want to keep my eyes open to see it in a theater, because I think that'd be
see
really,
it with other
really
people
cool.
too, and experience it with a crowd would be really cool too.
Totally. But yeah, so if you out there have seen the film or listened to the music or have feelings about Philip Glass, please get in touch with us. You can find us on social media at Great Song Pod. That's GR8 Song Pod, or send us an email at greatsongpod@gmail.com.
And we're on YouTube. You can find us on YouTube. Watch our episodes. Watch our bonus episode with the folks from the Austin Danger Pod. That was a lot of fun. So yeah, we're on YouTube at Great Song Pod as well.
Yeah, and be sure to, you know, like and subscribe, as they say. If you enjoy the show, leave us a rating and review. It really does help other people find it. Or, you know, you could help other people find it by telling them directly. Say, hey, I like this podcast and I think you would like this podcast, you should listen to it. I don't know. That could be cool.
If you know someone's password to get into their phone, take it, open the phone and subscribe to it. And then they'll look in their podcast app and they'll say, cool, a new podcast. Do whatever you got to do. We really appreciate it.
All right, Catherine, thank you so much, as always, for helping me do these episodes. I want to give a special shout out to Izzy for help with mixing, to Roger for the podcast art, to Skylar Spence, whose song Kratos in Love is our theme music. And most importantly, I want to give a special thanks to you, the listener, for listening. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye.